Serious now.
And it was a Saturday. We're going to lunch. Oh, I'll tell you.
Good morning and happy New Year's. Welcome to the January 4th, 2023 meeting of the Eastern Municipal Water District Board of Directors. We always start our meetings off with the Pledge of Allegiance. May I ask Director Armstrong, would you like to lead us this morning in our pledge?
Ready? Again?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much. Could I get the Board Secretary or ask the Board Secretary to read the ability to participate virtually in the meeting and then call a roll call for the board, please?
Yes. To avoid creating acoustic feedback, please mute all your devices during the meeting unless you are speaking. Before speaking, please unmute your device and turn down the volume of any other devices that are near you and tuned into the meeting. If you have joined by phone and would like to comment on an item, please press star 9 to let our staff know and wait to be notified. When it is your turn to speak, you will hear a notification asking you to unmute your phone by pressing star 6. If you have joined by computer, you may use the chat feature in Zoom to indicate your desire to speak. When done speaking, please mute your device again. Please participate from a quiet environment so that the board can hear you when you are speaking. Now we'll do the roll call. President Pauley?
Here.
Director Krona?
Here.
Director Slauson?
Here.
Director Armstrong?
Here.
Director Record is absent, and our legal counsel is here.
Very good. Thank you so much. April, do we have anybody wishing to do public comment on any item not on the agenda this morning?
No, we do not.
We do not. Very good. We will now move to item 2, which is election of officers of the board. In accordance with the provisions of Section 71273 of the Municipal Water District Law of 1911, this is the time and place for conducting an election of the president and vice president of the board for an ensuing two-year period. At this time, I'm going to turn the chairmanship of the board over to the secretary to conduct elections.
Nominations are open for the office of president of the board of directors.
I nominate Phil Pauley for president.
I second that.
Phil Pauley has been nominated for the office of president. We have a motion and a second to cast a vote for Director Phil Pauley to serve as president for 2023 and 2024.
Would you like to conduct the vote?
Sure. So we have a motion by Director Krona, a second by Director Armstrong. Please cast your vote. Director Pauley?
For myself.
Director Krona?
Phil. Well, I was talking to Matt Getz this morning, but I'm still going to vote for him.
Director Armstrong?
Yes.
So we have a hereby recognize a vote of 3-0 with Director, 4-0 with Director Record absent.
Very good. Would you like to conduct the election for Vice President?
Sure. Nominations are open for the office of Vice President of the Board of Directors for 2023 and 2024.
I nominate Steve Krona for Vice President.
I'll second that.
Okay, so Stephen Krona has been nominated for the office of vice president, and we have a motion and a second. Motion by Director Pauley and second by Director Slauson. And now please cast your vote. President Pauley?
For Steve Krona.
And Director Krona?
For Steve Krona.
And Director Slauson?
For Steve Krona.
And Director Armstrong?
For Steve Krona.
Okay, and we have a vote of 4-0 for Director Stephen Krona to serve as Vice President for 2023 and 2024. And now, President Pauley.
Thank you very much. Congratulations, Director Krona, for being Vice President. With that, after vote, I hear and I recognize the vote for, where are we?
So we are going to, at this time, we are going to accept motion.
Oh, I'm sorry. No. At this time, we are ready to accept a motion and a second to adopt the following resolution, establishing the appointment of the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District, President and Vice President for 2023-2024. The resolution we have just adopted approves the appointment of president and vice president for the board of directors. We will now turn to the regular agenda. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I believe that you had separate motions, but there's a resolution that needs to be addressed that essentially codifies the vote that the board
submitted. I'll make the motion. I'll second by Director Slauson.
Okay.
Call the roll, please.
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
All right. Thank you. We will now go on to item 3, which is our executive reports and the general manager. Mr. Mawad, good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. Happy New Year, and congratulations, President Pauly and Director Corona. My report is included in your packet under new and ongoing items. I wanted to provide the board a brief update on the status of the Sierra Nevada snowpack, as I'm sure you're seeing in the news. We've had quite a bit of storms up north, and yesterday the Department of Water Resources conducted the first snow survey of the year at Phillips Station, located south of Lake Tahoe. At that location, the survey recorded 55.5 inches of snow depth and a snow water equivalent of 17.5 inches. That's about 177% of average at this particular location. Statewide, DWR is reporting that snowpack is at 174% of average. Now, it's a great start of the year, but last year we saw similar conditions in December, and unfortunately that was followed by a historic dry month of January through March. But it is encouraging to see so much snowpack and precipitation up north. Now, to put some context to the water supply conditions, today we do have with us Metropolitan Water District's Water Resources Manager, Mr. Brad Coffey, who will be here later this morning to give you a briefing on water supply conditions and put the information that I just shared with you into context. Next item, I wanted to make you aware, as you may have heard, on December 29th, President Biden signed the $1.7 trillion spending budget. Of significance to EMWD is that the budget includes three congressionally directed spending earmarks. As you're aware, our funding for Quail Valley at $2.5 million, funding for Wine Country Infrastructure at $2 million, as well as the Well 56, Well 57 PFAS treatment at $3.5 million. Those are all included in the budget that President Biden just signed. So we're very pleased with that outcome. With this budget in place, it avoids a government shutdown, also provides funding until September of 2023. Next item that we have been very much involved with over a number of years, and we're glad it's finally advancing to construction. As you're aware, the Paris Valley Pipeline that has been constructed by the Metropolitan Water District, there was a reach that crosses Interstate 215 that was not constructed in the 2011 timeframe when the rest of the pipeline was, in fact, constructed. That missing gap has not allowed Metropolitan to put the South Paris Valley Pipeline into service. What I'm really pleased to report is that after advertising the project for bidding, Metropolitan will be presenting an item to their board next week for award of a construction contract in the amount of almost $60 million to Fowler Construction Company, a firm that we've worked with. Once completed, that pipeline will increase water supply from the Mills Water Filtration Plant to both Eastern and Western Municipal Water Districts. So it's a significant improvement in water delivery capacity to the entire region, and the estimated completion date for the construction is December of 2024. So we will be tracking that item next week at Metropolitan very closely. Next, I wanted to share with the board that myself, Jolene Walsh, and our legal counsel, Martin Kozelkowicz, have been involved in a series of interviews over the last couple of months in November, December, where we have been working with the SAPA member agencies and with the SAPA general manager, looking at whether we want to consider a legal strategy and legal approach region-wide to mitigate the impact and the financial burden associated with PFAS contamination. So there were three legal teams that were interviewed over the last couple of months. We will follow up with our SAPA member general managers and staff to determine whether this is something that we want to bring for your consideration in closed session. So more to follow as we get more clarity on whether this is a legal recourse that we want to pursue. We will be briefing the board in closed session accordingly. Again, the overarching goal of this effort is to recover damages, cost damages associated with PFAS contamination that are primarily a result of manufacturers of PFAS, specifically 3M and DuPont, versus having that cost burden placed on our ratepayers. Under items of interest to the board, wanted to make you aware that next week, on January 11th, the leadership of AQUA, specifically President Pam Tobin and Executive Director Dave Egerton, will be visiting EMWD, and we will be hosting them. We will also be providing a tour of our desalination complex. I think it's a great opportunity to continue to expand our partnership with AQUA assist each other on various initiatives that are underway. So if you are available to join that tour, would definitely encourage you to do so. Next, under items of interest of the board, I know Matt Melendrez is out this week, but from an operational perspective, I wanted to share some good news. With the recent storms, we've been able to capture since Monday 34 acre feet in the San Jacinto River and divert that water into our Grant Avenue ponds, replenish the groundwater basin. In fact, since November of 2022, we've captured and recharged 70 acre feet to date. As of yesterday, we're seeing a flow rate of about 4,000 gallons per minute. We expect that to increase with the storm coming in later today, and we expect that we will be able to capture additional flow that we can recharge into the basin. And finally, I wanted to share with the board that we're kicking off the year with a refocus and a reprioritization, making sure that we continue to focus on our safety of our employees and safety of the public. So next week, we will be kicking off a Safety First Week campaign, whereby every day we'll be sharing information with staff on the various resources and tools and efforts and training requirements that we have available. As you know, in December, we did conduct a district-wide stand-down to discuss safety issues, and we're going to be reviewing some of the feedback that we received from throughout the district with the staff. So again, this is an effort by the executive team as well as our safety risk and emergency management staff to continue making certain that we're doing everything we can to expand our culture of safety at EMWD. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I had one kind of a question, I guess, on the PFAS.
Yes.
Now, this is to look at damages, right?
Yes.
Eastern doesn't have any unpaid damages. I mean, we've been, the Air Force has been cooperating, so they've been,
Yes, it's a great question, Dr. Slauson. So, there's a couple considerations. You're absolutely right. The Air Force has been very collaborative and has partnered with EMWD to mitigate the impacts on Well 59. We do have another well, Well 56, which we decommissioned approximately 2 years ago. That well, the PFAS contamination, does not exceed the federal threshold, but does exceed the state threshold. So to date, the Air Force has been not willing to participate in an agreement to mitigate the impacts at Well 56. So we're still having conversations, including our legal counsel, regarding a potential tolling agreement. But beyond that specific Well 56, and as I mentioned earlier, we do have an earmark that was sponsored by Congressman Takano that's going to help us for the construction of the treatment of Well 56. The long-term concern, though, is that we are anticipating that the EPA is going to advance an MCL for PFAS. And if that occurs this year, the repercussions could be not only on the water side, but potentially on the wastewater side in terms of PFAS in recycled water or PFAS in biosolids. So there's uncertainty as far as the long-term cost burden associated with PFAS. For that reason, we, along with the others in the watershed, are exploring what our options are.
Okay, so it's also potentially... So
yes.
Potential liability on our part.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Laura, do you have anything for us this morning?
Yes, I do, President Pauley, and good morning, Board of Directors. Happy New Year. I wanted to inform the board that the district has kicked off our biannual budget process for the next two fiscal year cycle, starting fiscal 23-24 and 24-25. The departments are now building their operating and capital budgets and will be doing so through the end of February. We have three budget workshops planned for the board. The first one will be on March 1st, which will go over the assumptions of the budget. The second workshop will be April 5th, and we'll be going over top-level revenue, expense budget, CIP, and the OFA budget. And then budget workshop 3 will be bringing you a summary budget book, rate summary, and Prop 218 notices for the rate changes that we'll be proposing, and that will be on May 3rd. In addition, intertwined with all that, we're underway. The cost of service study is underway. We've already met with you. We do have a budget work. We have three more workshops with you on cost of service. The next one will be after the next board meeting on January 18th. It's a special study session for going over kind of the assumptions of the cost of service study and kind of giving you a vision of where we're at. This all will culminate into a public hearing for rates adoption and then the board approval of our budget on January 21st, 23. So we do have a busy 6 months ahead of us, some heavy lifting by the boards and staff, so I just wanted to give you a heads up on that. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Lanaya.
Good morning, President Pauley and members of the board. Happy New Year. No other report for me this morning.
Very good. With that, we will move on to item number 4, which is our consent calendar. Do we have any members of the board wishing to pull an item on the consent calendar for separate vote or separate questions or discussion? I'd just like to make a quick note on item C, which is to honor the life and service of Phil Williams. I'd known Phil for about 18 years, and I think he was a real pillar of the water community. As a longtime board member for Elsinore Valley, he collaborated here at Eastern on many different projects and really just was a loss to the water community in this area. So I'm glad that we are, as an official agency, recognizing the service of Director Williams at Elsinore. With that, I'll look for a motion and a second on the consent calendar.
I'll make that motion.
Second.
Director Armstrong, second by Vice President Corona. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauley?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. Move on to item 5, which is our action calendar. First is item A, which is to approve and authorize and award a contract to HDR Engineering Incorporated for $842,000 for the RWRF Rehabilitation Planning Study and Appropriation of $927,000. Mr. Chen, good morning, sir.
Good morning, President Pauley. Congratulations, and also board directors. Glad to see you all. My name is William Chen. That's as you introduced me, I really appreciate it. And this morning, I'll be presenting to you Regional Water Reclamation Facility Rehab Planning Study. And then in support of this particular project, to my right, I have Michael Flores from HDR.
Thank you for being here today, sir.
And so we are looking to seek approval of award or engineering contract with HDR. Next slide, please.
Mouse. William, there's a mouse here.
Oh, sorry. Oh, yes. I haven't done this too much. Sorry. Okay. Got it. Thank you. Okay, well, the objective of this particular project is to perform high-level operational and condition assessment of the four RWIFs that we have in our system. The idea is to develop a strategy and prioritize for rehab and system improvements that are necessary to maintain the reliable service of our facilities. As you can see, the four facilities are identified on the map to the right. Just quick project overview here. Again, it's a high-level operational and visual condition assessment. And what the consultant is going to be doing is they will compile incorporate past and current condition assessment that was done previously. And the map on the right, as an example, you can see areas identified in green were the ones that are going to be needing for condition assessment. The ones identified in yellow were the ones that have been done partially. And then the ones that are identified in red are the ones that have been completed previously. So we want to capture the good work that was completed previously and ensure that we can incorporate all those results as a way to develop the rehab and replacement plans. Of course, you know, we want to consider the budgetary costs associated with the with these things here. Truly, this provides a roadmap to develop short-term, mid-term, and also long-term CIP projects. So then September, we issued RFP to six consultants, and they are all very interested, and they all submitted the proposals. And through a selection panel composed of engineering and operation, we evaluated these proposals based on the criteria that's shown below. Now, in terms of the consultant selection summary, the selection committee felt that HDR provided the best proposal. They had the best team and a seasoned professional to work on this particular project, and also had a value-added approach in the proposal. I want to just take a little bit of time to explain what this value-added approach is. So basically, the consultant will dig through 22,000-plus maximal assets that, that's categorized in these RWIFs, and they, based on that, they have to dig through that and to increase the value of the assessment. This is the pre-planning work that has to occur, and this way we can develop a meaningful and accurate assessment information and results. So this truly is a structured approach to data processing analysis, such a way that we can be sure that data that we get produces quality decisions. And so with that, the end process really is develop a huge database, okay, of compiled information, and that can be shared across through different departments for further analysis and communications. Just to provide a brief summary, again, HDR will do the data compilation, QA/QC. They will physically go out there and collect data of all the facilities and to identify there was going to be safety, maintenance, operational, repair and rehab costs, and actions that are required. And with these R&R recommendation cost estimates and implementation schedule, that actually gave us a way to kind of look at the treatment plan holistically. Also, too, what that means is we're going to have a massive database at the end, in addition to an intuitive user interface dashboard that can be used. So that being said, the compiled database can be utilized by many departments in GIS, in Maxima, and also CIP program. So then should the board approve this particular project, we're looking to complete the field inspection sometimes in May, and we're looking to complete the project around October of this year. So then the recommendation for this morning is to approve and authorize the following. Execution of contract with HDR for this condition assessment work in the amount of about $842,000. Admin award or miscellaneous contracts, and also appropriation of $927,000 to fund the project cost through completion. So this completes my presentation. I'm happy to answer questions.
Do we have any questions on this item? Very good. I will look for a motion and a second on it.
Motion.
Moved by Director Slauson.
Second.
Second by Director Armstrong. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauley?
Aye.
Director Cronin?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. And again, I appreciate our guests from HDR being here this morning. As always, you do great work for the district. We look forward to working with you. So,
thank you, Board.
Thank you. Item B is to approve and authorize an execution of restated 1800 pressure zone water system facilities cost-sharing agreement. Mr. Wallace, good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. I'm here today to present this item for your consideration and approval. But first, I'd like to acknowledge our contract annuitant, Warren Back, for his thoughtful and diligent efforts on this throughout last year to facilitate this agreement update. And, you know, he was working with a lot of developers, staff, and legal counsels to get this in its current form, and it was quite a bit of effort. So with this presentation today, I will first provide background on the current and proposed agreements, including their purpose as well as what the drivers are for this amended agreement. Next, I'll present a geographic overview of the track projects as well as the required facilities. And last, I will provide the facility cost sharing arrangement in its current form as well as some key terms and conditions. Regarding background, the initial cost sharing agreements, and there were four total, were executed in late 2018. The developers pooled their resources as part of this to advance significant water facility improvements to serve their projects. As part of the agreement, EMWD agreed to administer this cost sharing arrangement with the developers. Since 2018, several notable drivers were evident, and the developers requested that EMWD consider amending this agreement. There were two developer reassignments. Home builders Woodside and Pulte purchased entitled land and began developing. Facility cost increases that were quite significant were quantified through the developers' design efforts over the last few years. Facility costs rose from about $7.2 million to just over $16 million, almost $17 million. Also, additional developer participation in project units were arranged with one additional developer, and it brought the unit count from 1,166 to 1,325 units to spread these costs. With this request to amend, EMWD proposed a consolidated agreement form and also proposed a simplification of its administrative role in this agreement. This slide depicts the geographic location references for the projects as well as the facilities. Track developments are generally located along the hillsides of Valley Boulevard, west of Valley Boulevard, primarily between McLaughlin and Ridgemore Roads. Key takeaways from this slide include the location of the 1800 pressure zone tank, the new Quail 3 tank, which will be constructed, and 3 miles, over 3 miles of 18-inch pipeline in Valley Boulevard, both of which are sizable cost-sharing elements between these developers. This slide is a summary of the required facilities and identifies the facility implementation sponsors, the basis of their cost-sharing, and the anticipated facilities implementation schedule. So the key takeaways from this this slide are the who, what, and when. For the who and the what, Woodside and Pulte are leading the implementation of these required facilities, with Pulte doing the lion's share of the facilities implementation, namely the Valley Boulevard pipeline and Quail 3 tank, combined total of about $15 million. And then for the when, Woodside, their current schedule, they're wrapping up their project. Selling and constructing their final lots, and they are underway with the Ridgemore pump station improvements and the upsizing of the 18-inch pipeline about 900 feet. They expect to be completed early this year. Pulte is just starting their project, and their required facilities construction, their schedule is proposed to build these over the next 2 years through 2025. This slide depicts the detailed cost-sharing breakdown amongst the parties. including Woodside and Pulte's upfront facilities implementation costs and the remaining developer equity payments. The developer's lump sum equity payments will be paid through EMWD as a pass-through to Pulte, and those pass-through payments that EMWD would receive from these non-sponsoring developers equate to about $5.5 million. In addition, EMWD retains an equity payment for the developer's utilization of EMWD's existing tank site for the Quail 3 tank, and that equity payment to Eastern totals about $134,000. Over the next couple slides here, I've identified a few agreement points. The current agreement now includes a fixed cost-sharing methodology reflecting the current market costs and avoiding the complex reconciliation effort between the parties. In addition, the current agreement refined a staged implementation schedule for the required facilities to assist the developers with their build-out schedule, as well as lead times for construction, et cetera. Also, EMWD maintains its lead role as lead agency for the Quail 3 tank and its administrative role in the agreement as the pass-through agency. Additionally, the current agreement adds the potential reimbursement frontage payments by non-parties, so developers that would develop along Valley Boulevard that aren't party to this agreement would pay a frontage charge as a fairness charge for that pipeline built by these developers. In addition, the board adopted a policy update as part of the FPC updates that were recently done for storage fee credits by reduced FPCs, or financial participation charge. So EMWD will be administering that as well, which will be passed back through this agreement to the developers. To close, staff recommends that the board approve and authorize the execution of a restated 1800 pressure zone water system facilities cost sharing agreement by the general manager or his designee, subject to non-substantive changes. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions on this item?
Questions?
I will look for a motion and a second then.
So
moved by Director Corona.
Second.
Second by Director Armstrong. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Cronin?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. Thank you very much for a good presentation. We'll move on to item C, which is to approve and authorize an agreement with Richard Brady & Associates Incorporated for $911,000 for the design of the Ridgecrest Road tank, an additional appropriation in the amount of $1.5 million. Good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly. Good morning, members of the board. My name is Sam Valdez, senior civil engineer in the engineering department. Appreciate the opportunity to present staff's recommendation for award of contract with Brady for preliminary and final design of the Ridgecrest Road tank. First, I would like to recognize a couple of guests that we have with us today, Chris Dull and Carl Kubitz. With Brady.
Thank you for being here. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you for being here. Mm-hmm. And with that, I'll get into some background for the project. It is located in the community of Winchester near the intersection of Dominigoni Parkway and Leon Road, and will serve the district's 1720 Winchester Hills pressure zone, which is shown in the figure in light blue. The proposed tank will provide potable water supply and system pressure reliability, as well as emergency storage in the event of a fire or supply outage. The project is critical to support continued development within the 1720 pressure zone. It is also one of the regional facilities part of the Winchester Special Benefit Area, or SBA And will be funded in part through SBA water surcharge fees. The major project elements include a water storage tank up to 4 million gallons in volume, approximately 3,200 linear feet of 24-inch diameter transmission pipeline. This is to connect the tank to the distribution system, as well as associated site and access road improvements. We have budgeted to prepare an environmental impact report, or EIR. As part of the EIR, we will perform a siting study for alternative site and pipeline alignments in accordance with CEQA requirements. On September 12th of this year, we issued an RFP, and in October, we received four proposals. A cross-sectional selection panel evaluated and scored the proposals in accordance with the evaluation criteria shown here. The top-ranking firm and best value was Brady, based on their extensive experience in designing and constructing large diameter water storage tanks under challenging conditions, their detailed siting study approach, and also their understanding of the local constraints and project drivers. Staff negotiated the scope and fee with Brady, which totals approximately $911,000, as shown highlighted in the table. Brady's team also includes a collection of sub-consultants for supporting services, for example, geotechnical investigation, survey, and potholing. Majority of these sub-consultants are local to the area and on the district's as-needed services list. Brady's scope of work includes tasks typical for an engineering design project, including project management, field investigations, preparing construction bid documents, and bid phase support services. Brady's siting study and preliminary design will also help to confirm any real property needs for the project. And a breakdown of Brady's fee is provided in the table shown here. To support the CEQA for the project, staff requested and negotiated a scope and fee with Helix, who was previously competitively selected as part of the district's as-needed environmental consulting services. Helix's scope of work includes typical environmental services associated with the preparation of an EIR, including biological and cultural surveys, environmental impact analyses, and report preparation. Should we receive the board's approval, we look to begin the project immediately. And look to complete the CEQA and preliminary design in late 2024, with final design completion and bid advertisement in late 2025. So with that, staff's recommendations are as follows. Execution of contract with Brady for the preliminary and final design of the Ridgecrest Road tank in the amount of approximately $911,000. Execution of contract with Helix for environmental consulting services in the amount of approximately $248,000. Authorization to initiate negotiations and enter escrow for any real property needs to complete the project. Administrative award of ancillary contracts necessary to complete the work, and additional appropriation of approximately $1.5 million to fund the project through the completion of the final design and bid award phases. So that completes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the board?
I have one. Have we worked with the Brady firm before?
No, this would be the first project with Brady.
I would welcome. Do you want to just give a quick brief on who you guys are, if you don't want to come forward and be my guest?
Thank you, President Pauly. Board members, my name is Christopher Dahl. I'm the president of Richard Brady & Associates. Brady is a water, wastewater engineering firm specializing in design and construction of water and wastewater facilities based here in Southern California. Been working for nearly 25 years as a company. We've done work throughout Southern California, Orange County, San Diego County. We have a couple of on-call contracts with Metropolitan Water District, as well as some additional work we've done on projects for them. One of our highlighted projects is the City of Upland. We designed a 7.5 million gallon pre-stressed concrete water tank, which is nearing construction, probably be entering service next month. And we just recently completed a seismic assessment of all of the water reservoirs for the City of Redlands to prepare them to be ready to access funds from a new FEMA grant that's coming out for seismic rehabilitation for water facilities. So we know the area. We've done work throughout Southern California, and this is kind of right up our sweet spot of water tanks.
Well, very good. I appreciate you being here. I always like to give new firms the opportunity to introduce themselves to the district. So
we appreciate that, and we look forward to this project.
Thank you very much. With that, I will look for a motion and a second on this item. Director Armstrong, you want to make the motion?
I'll make the
Director
motion.
Slauson would like to second it. I'll get a roll call vote, please.
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. Again, thank you for being here. Look forward to working with you.
Thank you.
With that, we will move on to item D, which is to approve and authorize a contract with E.G. Meyer and Company for $295,000 under specification 1492S Indian Street Sewer Replacement North Project, an additional appropriation of $534,000. Good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly and board members. Happy New Year. I'm Scott Tolan. I'm pleased to present a recommendation for construction for the Indian Sewer Street Sewer Replacement North Project. There we go. This project is driven by the festival's specific plan and is located in the city of Moreno Valley. As can be seen by the graphic, the area is just north of the SR-60 between Hecock and Indian Street. The sewer flows for the area will split into two separate sewer sheds. The one indicated in tan flows to the Hecock Street, and the rest of the area flows to our Indian Street, which is the topic of today's presentation. This bird's eye view provides a better depiction of the overall project phases. Originally, this was going to be a single sewer replacement project that intercepts an existing manhole at the kind of northern end there, shown up adjacent to the Wood Springs Suites Hotel. And then it transitions to the south, crossing SR-60 down to a tie-in point on Sunnymead Boulevard. However, in order to accommodate the aggressive schedule of the Wood Springs Suites Hotel, we separated the project into the two phases. So today's phase is phase one, and that focuses on the small segment of sewer and a couple manholes installed in the property of the Wood Springs Hotel. Phase two will continue. We're continuing design, and that'll be later on throughout this year. So the phase one project was advertised on December 1st of 2022. We received four bids on December 12th. H7 Contracting withdrew their bid due to a clerical error. Therefore, E.J. Meyer Company submitted the lowest responsive bid in the amount of approximately $295,000. In contrast, the engineering estimate was about 15% higher at $349,000. The primary difference there was the additional contingencies that we've been including for the uncertain market conditions. In addition to the construction, we negotiated engineering services support with Corollo Engineers, who was the design engineer for this phase of the project. We also negotiated supporting contracts with Michael Baker International for survey and Converse Consultants for soil testing for a total amount of support services of approximately $47,000. Oops. The schedule. Upon approval by the board, we'll start this month with construction. It's a rather short duration. Again, it's a small segment of sewer and a couple manholes, so we're looking at 120 days of construction with completion in May. So staff's recommendation today is for the approval and authorization of a construction contract with E.J. Myers Company in the amount of $295,000. Execution by the general manager for support contracts with Corollo Engineering in the amount of $30,000 and the administrative award and execution of ancillary support contracts. Additional appropriation of approximately $434,000, which brings the total estimated project cost to approximately $555,000. With that, I'll open it up for questions.
Any questions on this item? For a motion and a second, a motion by Director Schlossing, second by Director Corona. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Schlossing?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Passes 4-0 with director record absent. Thank you so much for that. We're going to go on to our informational items. I'm going to take these a little out of order since Nicole is sitting here. Would you like to, why don't we do item B first, if you're ready for that.
Good morning,
Nicole.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. Happy New Year. I am pleased to present to you today the fiscal year 22-23 first quarter enterprise performance measures update. So on your screen, we have an overview of the 12 measures that make up the district's balanced scorecard. And the beginning of a new fiscal year provides us an opportunity to take a look at our goals and just review the most prudent goals to see whether we need to update any of them. We have updated several of the financial goals going into the fiscal year based on the 22-23 mid-cycle budget that the board approved in June of last year. So as we look at each of these measures in detail, I will discuss any changes to the goals. We did go over these in a little more detail at the committee, so I'll just provide a more general overview, but please stop me if there are any questions. So the first metric is the water operating cost per acre foot delivered. The goal for this measure has been updated, consistent with the mid-cycle budget update. So the new monthly goal was calculated using the $152 million dollars estimated in operating costs for water service and divided by an anticipated 68,600 acre feet in water deliveries. So now the current average that we're looking at for operating costs is $2,220 per acre feet, and that's further adjusted for seasonal demands. So you will see that our goal line shown on the bar graph in blue fluctuates slightly or moves along trend with demand. For the first quarter, you can see that we are below cost and slightly below the average and on trend for the first quarter. Now we'll look at the wastewater treatment operating costs per million gallons treated. And again, the goal for this metric was revised to reflect the mid-cycle budget. So the operating costs of $75.1 million were divided by the 47 million gallons estimated over 365 days. So the new monthly goal is $4,382 per million gallons. And the bar chart shows that for the first quarter, we were below the cost goal, so we're trending well for the first quarter. Our next measure is the recycled water storage. You may recall that this measure was added last quarter. The goal is to maintain recycled water storage levels between 75 and 100% of our forecasted storage amount. And based on the bar chart, you can see that we are within goal. And as a part of looking at our recycled water storage, we also look at usage. So this chart provides a more detailed look at our actual usage versus our two-year average. And the chart shows that we're trending very well. At the end of September, we were slightly below target. And our recycled water operations team attributes that to changes in farming habits due to the drought. So we've had some changes in the type of crops that farmers are growing. And we've seen a move to less water-intensive crops, so less sod, for example. The next measure is the self-generated power. And the goal is to utilize at least 90% of our contracted power or to generate at least 90% or more of our contracted power generation. And with the addition of the solar facilities last fiscal year, we are well above our target. And this slide just shows a more detailed breakdown. So we have, as you can see, the majority of our power generation is solar, and then the green shows the amount contributed by the microturbine. So the next measure is our customer hours out of service. Our bar chart shows that we exceeded our goal in August and September. So what we're looking at, the customer hours out of service looks at the hours that customers are out of service per 1,000 customer accounts. So in August, we had 18.08 hours. Just over half of those hours were unplanned outages. The remaining were planned outages. The biggest contributing outage in August was an 8-inch mainline repair in Homeland. And as I mentioned, it was unplanned, and it lasted 4.5 hours, and 159 customers were affected by this outage. In September, we had several unplanned outages, and the largest outage, though, was a planned outage, and it was a pressure zone 1764 regulated upgrade. That outage lasted 6 hours and affected 47 customers. Our next metric is the wastewater treatment reliability. And this metric looks at the system, our facility average uptime for wastewater facilities. And this is important for our recycled water production. Our goal is 98%, and the chart shows that we are meeting and exceeding our goal each month. The next goal is the next metric is the wastewater spills for collection and recycled water. The RWRF systems. Our goal is to have less than 3 spills a month. We prefer not to have any, but we did have 1 spill per month during the first quarter. In July, we had a spill that occurred in Murrieta on Poroy Road. And it was caused by a force main leak. The amount that spilled was 800 gallons. All of it was recovered, as well as the washdown water. On August 11th, we had a spill at the Day Street lift station due to a valve leak. and the amount spilled was 1,200 gallons, and approximately 300 were recovered. And finally, in September, on the 27th, we had a spill that occurred at the Day Street lift station while a contractor was replacing a spool in the wet well piping. 150 gallons were spilled, and only a third of it was recovered. And next, we look at the customer satisfaction score for the first quarter. Our goal remains at 4 out of 5, and we are trending well. In the first quarter, you can see we ended September at 4.5. The next measure is the safety, injury, and illness rate. Now, we've kept the goal at 3. We felt it was prudent to keep this goal at 3 after discussion with the safety and risk management team. We do expect to see this number increase. It's expressed as a rolling average, and because of injuries that have occurred, we'll see that impact over time. So our current rate still remains low compared to the industry average, but as General Manager Muad mentioned in his report, we are recognizing and confirming that safety is still a priority for the district and taking steps to, in that direction. The next goal is a financial measure. The general and administrative costs as a percent of total operating cost. The goal has been revised based on the budget, and it is now 11.6%. As you can see in the bar chart, we've got September at slightly above at 11.7%, which is pretty much attributed to rounding. It's pretty much on target. And our next measure is the net operating margin, which is our revenue minus cost. Based on the budget, we're calculating a monthly average margin of $2.73 million. And again, this is adjusted for seasonal changes, seasonal trends. So you will see that goal line fluctuate based on seasonal changes. Sorry about that. I clicked too soon. So for the first quarter, you can see we were above goal in each of the 3 months. And our last measure is the capital improvement project actual to budget, which measures our implementation. Our goal is to implement 75% of the forecast, and we ended the quarter at 101%. We started off slow, which is in July, which is normal. There's the normal trend we've seen over past fiscal years. We tend to have a slow start with the CIP implementation, and then we pick up in the second quarter. So in October, we're right at about 85% implementation rate. So we're trending really well. So to conclude my report, as you've seen, 10 of the measures are performing better than the monthly goal. 2 of the measures are on the watch list, the customer hours out of service and the capital improvement plan. We are scheduled for the next report in March. And with that, I'll take any questions you may have.
Any questions?
No, very good.
I had one, and Mr. Adams, if you could, if you want to come forward, I know you're doing very important work back there, but
we discussed at the admin committee on the capital improvement plan budget, perhaps smoothing that out with the vehicle purchases and how we account for that. Is that correct?
Yeah, so we make orders at the beginning of the year, but we really don't expense it until the vehicles are purchased. So we're talking about encumbering those funds so that the report shows how we're making those commitments and being able to be consistent with how we're spending that funds.
Okay. I always feel on the CIP report we're a little dragging behind, and it's not really reflecting the work that's being done.
John, do you want to mention our new system that we're looking
at? Just going, as Laura mentioned, we are looking at a new ERP, which will allow us to encumber those funds and to show what has been committed, so you have a better sense of what we've committed to and what we're spending, and those numbers would be a lot tighter from that perspective.
Okay. I think the board would appreciate it if we could streamline that a little bit. So thank you very much. Cool. Thank you, Nicole, for an excellent report. Appreciate it. Why don't we do this? Let's do item C with our legal counsel. Then we will take a break before hearing from Metropolitan, if that works for everybody. Mr. O'Neill.
Good morning. Sheila, do you have it?
Yes, just one moment, Stephen.
Yeah, this is an overview of where we are in terms of the remote meetings. It's a little bit of a history lesson about the original Brown Act requirements, where we went through with pre and post COVID. So can I operate these slides?
Yes.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, so just to start the discussion, I thought it was prudent to revisit the Brown Act discussion, statutes about what constitutes a legislative body for purposes of this Brown Act, because it does implicate some of our committees. And basically, as I'm sure you know, the legislative body for this district is a majority of the board. When you have three of you together to discuss board business, that constitutes the body of the board, and that constitutes a meeting. But committees are a little different. The Brown Act excludes certain committees that are advisory committees. However, it goes on to say, as you can see on the highlighted language there, that if there's a standing committee, which means a committee that has a standing subject matter jurisdiction, or it meets on a regular basis, that's considered to be a standing committee, and it is subject to the Brown Act requirements for notice and things like that. So, like, for example, I believe, your exec committee would be, of course, a standing committee, but we have now the South Orange County DSAL committee, which is, I assume, for kind of a limited purpose and limited scope, that would most likely be considered an ad hoc committee. But for purposes of standing committee, they are subject to the Brown Act requirements. So you may recall from the days of those long ago days of pre-COVID that we had certain requirements. If you're going to have participate in a telephonic meeting, and those are listed here. It was, in my experience, not often used, because the agency or the district had to give notice of where that location would be. The location had to be accessible to the public. Members of the public had to be allowed to attend that location, and also you had to post at that location. And so I did see it a few times where someone would be at a conference and wanting to participate. Maybe you've been through that. You had to post an agenda at your hotel room and leave the door open so the public could attend if they wanted to attend. On another district I know did it from the Philippines, which is a little crazy, because presumably no one was going to be there for the meeting. But those are the requirements, and it's important to note those requirements haven't changed. They're still valid law. As we go through this, you'll see that section 54953, which covers these remote meetings and telephonic attendance, has been amended, but only for temporary periods. So 54953, the original 54953, is still good law. But then we see in March 2020, with the pandemic arising and at the time when we were washing our grocery bags, that the governor decided that it was prudent to really relax the requirements so that public agencies such as the district could continue to meet remotely, conduct the public's business, but with very relaxed requirements. Those requirements that we see in 54953 were excused. If there was a teleconference attendee, that location did not have to be identified. The teleconference location did not have to be open and accessible to the public, so we could all participate from our living rooms or our kitchens and not have the public be present. And also, we did have to provide a requirement for the through the teleconferencing technology to allow the public to participate. And we see that on the next slide, because while it excused some of the requirements of 54953, it did implement new requirements that were designed to ensure the public could participate. So the public could comment remotely. There has to be a procedure to swiftly respond to requests for accommodation. And the public participation has to be, again, it's kind of to stress the transparency of the whole process. You had to make accommodations to make sure the public could participate and the meetings were accessible through the technology. Well, in we see that, again, in the executive order was in place all the way through 2020 and all the way through 2021 up to September. And we see that at that point the executive order was withdrawn and the legislature responded with AB 361, which we're currently operating in under now. The two underpinnings for AB 361 is that there has to be a proclaimed state of emergency by the governor and that state or local officials have imposed or just recommended measures to promote social distancing. And those are in place currently, those recommendations in Riverside County. And we also still have the governor's emergency order in place for another 2 months or so. But these are the elements listed on this slide of the requirements to have an AB 361 meeting. And we have to make this finding on a monthly basis that meeting in person could pose essentially a health risk if we did not meet, if we did continue to meet in person. And we have these other requirements from AB 361. We have to provide notice and post the agendas, conduct the virtual meetings, again, that protects all the rights of the parties and the public, stressing the transparency of the whole process. And a new twist on this was that if there was some upset in the communications, the meeting has to be suspended until those technological problems were addressed and so the public could continue to participate. I have had that issue at other public meetings, but fortunately we haven't had that issue here. Everything's been running pretty smoothly with the technology, and we haven't had to suspend any of the meetings. AB 361 is designed to expire or sunset on next year in January. And so we're kind of looking at that situation now because currently AB 361 is in place. However, and these slides are a little out of sync, but the governor announced back in October that this state of emergency pertaining to the pandemic will expire February 28, 2023. So at the end of next month, we're not going to have one of the kind of crucial underpinnings to allow for the AB 361 meetings. And I don't know if it was in anticipation of that or just another another member of the legislature determining that there should be a continuation of the remote meeting procedures. And so in September, we got this new law, AB 2449, which goes into effect. It's in effect now. It goes into effect January of this month and of this year. And so it again amends the underpinning or the original 54953. Similar to AB 361, we're not required to post the agendas at the teleconference locations. We're not obligated to identify all the teleconference locations, and you don't have to make each location open to the public. So it's similar to AB 361, but you'll see it adds a lot more requirements, in my view. In this situation, under AB 2449, there has to be a majority of the board in a physical same location. So if Director Armstrong was going to participate under AB 2449, the remainder of the board has to be present in one location. Previously, under 54953, that's not a requirement. It's just the remainder of the board has to be meeting within the jurisdiction of the agency. So it's a little tighter in that sense. And then it requires that the member who is going to participate or who wants to participate remotely has to show two things, or there's two excuses or two reasons to do it. It's very limiting now. It has to be what's called just cause, which you'll see is defined there, and very specific. It concerns a need for child care, or if there's a physical or mental disability that is not otherwise accommodated for by the agency, that member can participate there, or while you're traveling on business of the district. So if you're up in Sacramento for a meeting, that would constitute just cause. The other one is a little more, significant, or tends to, it looks like it's designed to cover just a medical contingency, and that's under emergency circumstances. That's when a family member or the director, his or herself, has an emergency and will prevent them from participating in person, so they will be allowed to call in remotely. And in both of these situations, it contemplates that the director is going to notify the body in advance, either that there is I have just cause to not attend, or that I have an emergency. And then the agency has to deliberate and make a motion approving that remote attendance at the meeting. So it could happen, again, using Director Armstrong as an example, if something came up a day in advance that constituted just cause or an emergency, he could notify Joe, and it could be agendized as a motion. But it also allows, if it comes up the day of the meeting, it can be addressed at the front of the meeting that there is just cause or an emergency that needs to be addressed. Other limitations, as you can see here, if you cannot do this for more than three consecutive months, or 20% of the regular meetings within the calendar year. I guess we meet twice a month. We meet 24 times a year. So I can't do that math, but whatever 20% of 24 is, we can't exceed that. So it's a pretty limiting. There's some certain limitations that, in my view, make it somewhat onerous to avail yourself of 2449. Okay, here's some other requirements, one of them I just don't understand, that you have to. I understand the point that you have to have both audio and visual technology so the public can participate and see you as a member participate. But they also have to disclose whether any individual of the age of 18 is present at the remote location, and I don't really know what that's about. But again, that we have these technological requirements, the two-way audio-visual platform or a telephone service, and with a live webcast has to be present. And if there's someone who has needs accommodations to participate, we have to make some accommodations in that regard. And if there's a disruptive event at the meeting, we can't take action. So similar to AB 361, if there's some communications problem, this appears to be designed to require that no action be taken, because presumably that would prevent the public from participating. So this is in effect right now, and it's going to be in effect through 2025, and then after January 2026, we'll have Government Code Section 54953, the original telephonic statute in place. So again, this last slide talks about the fact that the governor announced in advance that that emergency, that pandemic-related emergency that allowed for AB 361 is going to be withdrawn, and so that leaves the agency with two options, 2449 through January 2025, or the original Brown Act requirements, which allow for the, or require the posting at the location where you're attending remotely. So I know this is a fair amount of statutory gobbledygook, but basically, the two options are right now, well, actually, after February, will be 2449 with those just cause or emergency requirements, or the basic 54953.
And Stephen, if I could add, that there's no decision per se for the board. This is simply information that we're sharing. If after February 28th, a board member wants to exercise their right under 2449, Stephen wanted to provide you with the just cause or the emergency criteria. And then, of course, you'll if you can, notify us as soon as you're aware of those conditions so we can plan accordingly. Because as Stephen mentioned, we want to make sure there's adequate quorum in person.
So no action has to take place. We can comply with 2449 if we find it's necessary.
That's correct.
Yeah, if you're going to be up in Sacramento and you know there's a meeting coming or you're somewhere, I suggest you contact staff, contact me, and we can talk about what would be the best way to do that.
And the 2449 is a little more liberal than the Brown Act as it stands now.
Yes and no. I mean, the Brown Act as it stands now would require that you notify the board or the staff. You'd have to post an agenda where you are. You'd have to open your door, make it accessible to the public. I know some directors do it in a hotel lobby where they have the agenda on the table of a hotel lobby. Or and we also have to put on the agenda for this meeting where you will be, right? So those are the requirements. Under 2449, there has to be some more process at the district. Let's say you it's a just cause issue. Something physical that prevents you from coming here. May not be an emergency, but it is a just cause issue. You'd have to notify the board, has to come here, and you have to have a vote to approve that, and then you have those other restrictions about the number of times you can do that, et cetera. So it's both of them are not real facile, but they're, in my view, the 54953 seem to be a little cleaner. But.
When I was with the state agency board, I did that a couple times. It was instead of meeting in Sacramento, I posted up my office, and that worked out. Okay, thank you.
So Stephen is, and first of all, I mean, I think the entire Brown Act needs to be looked at the state legislative level just to bring it into modern times. But from what it sounded like, is our committee meetings, for example, the admin committee is. It almost sounds like that's not really a Brown Actable committee under these rules.
Well, it is. Under that original section, I don't know how I go back on this, but.
That's what I mean. We're not taking official action on public.
I think if the committee recommendations are standing committee and the recommendations are routinely accepted.
Yes, if it's a standing committee and it has to do with the nature of that committee. If it has standing subject matter jurisdiction, it is determined to be a Brown Act meeting. So it would require the Brown Act notice. I'm sorry, I'm really getting slow through this, but
and that's fine. I mean, I'm just it's so we could have a committee meeting now that doesn't require either of the board members of that committee to be physically in attendance. Correct.
Well, if you
if we follow the protocols,
if it's an ad hoc committee, yes, you don't need notice. You don't need Brown Act notice. It's not a Brown Act meeting. Mm-hmm. If it is like a standing committee, it becomes this question of what's a quorum of a two-member committee.
Yeah,
committees are not designed to take action. Yeah. They're designed to make recommendations. And so when I walked through this with Joe a while back, when you look at the definition of quorum, it's a definition that defines what is needed to take action. Well, you have this body that's really not designed to take action. It's designed to make recommendations. So it becomes this, I don't know if that's chicken and the egg, or it becomes this somewhat existential question about what is a committee and what is a quorum of a committee if the committee isn't designed to take action. So I know I'm not answering your question.
Well, no,
but,
you are. I mean,
and maybe President Pauly, if I can add, our past practice pre-COVID was that one board member at a standing committee constitutes a quorum.
Oh,
Okay.
We've had on occasion a board member not able to attend a committee, a standing committee. We still proceeded with that committee meeting if we had one board member. So that's been our interpretation. And I don't know if you agree with that.
I think that's a reasonable interpretation. Yeah. I mean, if you're going to have, you're allowing for less than a full body to take action as a board, right? You can take action with three, and you have a committee of two. Could one committee member make a recommendation to the board without the committee member present? And so kind of a policy decision. But I will note that agencies like Metropolitan, they solve the committee question by making all their committee meetings also special meetings, joint special meeting of the board. So that allows non-committee members to participate because it's deemed a special meeting of the entire board. Some of my clients do that as well. They notice their committees as special meetings of the board, but the agenda says we're meeting as a committee. There's not going to be any board action. There's going to be a recommendation to the board arising in this committee. But because it's a special meeting of the board, other members can participate. Because if it's just a pure standing committee, like Brown Act committee meeting, and it's not noticed as a special meeting, a third board member could attend but not participate. They could observe. And that's in the Brown Act and in some attorney general opinions interpreting that section of the Brown Act. So by noticing a committee meeting as a special meeting of the board, a third, a fourth, or perhaps even fifth board member could attend and participate. But that committee will not be taking any board action. It will just be taking the subject matter and making a recommendation. Does that make sense?
That's the way it is at Rancho. Every meeting is a board meeting.
All right.
So, you know, and then you have this, you have the actual committee members that will participate or do any voting, and then but all the other members can comment and, you know, give their opinion, whatever.
And an alternate. The committees had an alternate too, in case one of the committee members wasn't there, the alternate could step in.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because some of these, you know, committee items, committee agenda items are pretty significant, and I know some directors would like to weigh in early on instead of, you know, just jumping in at a board meeting and having that discussion. So I think it serves the purpose well.
One additional consideration is we do have a significant number of ad hoc committee meetings. As you're all aware, ad hoc committees with our neighboring agencies where we have two of our board members participate, those don't fall under the Brown Act. We have chosen to notice those meetings. We've chosen to allow public participation in those ad hoc committee meetings. But as Stephen clarified earlier, those ad hoc committee meetings are not subject to the Brown Act requirements. And we can continue to have those virtually if that's the preference.
Like I said, I think the Brown Act needs probably, the legislature needs to look at how to update the Brown Act to deal with today's modern times. But Appreciate the update. Thank you very much. With that, why don't we take a short break? We'll resume our meeting, bring us back to order here. Under informational items, we are going to do item A, which is a presentation. Mr. Brad Coffey of the Metropolitan Water District. Mr. Mawan, would you like to do the introduction on this?
Yeah, thank you, President Pauly, members of the board. So we're very fortunate today to have with us Mr. Brad Coffey. He is Metropolitan Water District's Water Resource Manager. And Brad joined Metropolitan in 1990 as an assistant engineer 32-plus years ago, and he's had various responsibilities, overseeing many initiatives at Metropolitan. Currently, as a resource manager, water resource manager, he is has oversight over Metropolitan's imported water supplies as well as local resources. He oversees their water use efficiency program, as well as he oversees the demand and supply forecast for Metropolitan. Brad is a registered engineer. He earned his engineering degree from Virginia Tech University, and then he also earned his degree in public administration from USC. And one thing about Brad is I really appreciate his insight and thoughtfulness in dealing with sometimes very complex water supply issues. And we're fortunate that we've built a great working relationship with Brad and his entire team. With that, Brad,
Welcome.
I really appreciate the opportunity to be here in person and not just on Zoom, so I appreciate being able to be with you. I was here a number of years ago before the pandemic, and it's just great to visit with you again. I also want to just acknowledge committee member Armstrong, or board member Armstrong, as coming on to the Metropolitan Board, and to acknowledge Director Record's long service with Metropolitan. I told Director Record that I learned a lot from him. I appreciated his partnership, and I look forward to the same with Mr. Armstrong. So I can talk about the recent conditions, kind of the good news, but my presentation is mostly about the drought. President Pauley, would you prefer to hear the good news first or the good news second?
I'm going to leave that to you. Okay. You were the presenter.
Well, I'm going to talk about the hole that we are in first, and then how we're beginning to climb out of the hole. And this is just forward. So Southern California's water sources are stressed. We receive about 30% of the supply from the State Water Project, a quarter of the supply from the Colorado River, and about 45% of the supply is locally produced. That includes things like the recycled water that Eastern is so effective at. But we've just left the three driest years of record in Northern California in the State Water Project. We are in a 23-year drought on the Colorado. In fact, Southwest North America hasn't seen a drought this significant in 1,200 years. So it's literally a drought of biblical proportions. And that drought has also visited Southern California itself. There's declining groundwater conditions. The City of Los Angeles Aqueduct experiences the same stresses in the Southern Sierra, and there is groundwater contamination. So there's a number of factors that have been constraining our water supply. Now, we have quite a flexible water supply, and we can move water throughout much of our system, but we've really maxed that out. During this drought, we've been pulling on the Colorado River and pushing the water as far into the system as we can to replace the lower State Water Project supplies. In fact, one of the things we did is we worked with Department of Water Resources, and we are moving water backwards through the Santa Ana Valley Pipeline, and we're pulling water out of Diamond Valley Lake that was previously stored State Water Project supplies, feeding it to the Mills plant and then to this area. So that is a new operation and one of the ways that we've been kind of maxing out our system. But we still came up short, and so we had to initiate an emergency water conservation program for six member agencies, about 7 million people, where we have required either one day per week watering, which is of 10 minutes duration or less, or complying with strict volumetric limits. And that's where our most significant and immediate challenge is. We also have just many competing interests for regional storage. And let me walk you through this graphic a little bit. The blue bars are the total storage volume capacity that we've had available. And you see how it's grown more than 13-fold since the early 1980s. There in 1999, we finished the construction of Diamond Valley Lake, other groundwater programs. Lake Mead storage is the large jump in, say, 2007 there. And then the green bars is the total amount of that water that we have in storage. So how full is the total amount of storage? And then we always keep a volume of water available inside the San Andreas Fault in case of the big one that would sever the Colorado River Aqueduct, the State Water Project system, and the Los Angeles Aqueduct. So that's kind of a no-touch on the emergency storage. Now, it's easy to think of this as kind of one monolithic storage, but it really isn't. And in fact, these bubbles represent the relative size and what all the different elements of storage are. And the biggest element of a storage is our Lake Mead, what's called intentionally created surplus water in Lake Mead. We have about 1.3 million acre feet there, and that is allowed as part of the negotiations where if we do something like water conservation, water recycling, intentionally use less water, we can bank water in Lake Mead. In fact, the top about 16 or 19 feet of water in Lake Mead is Metropolitan's intentionally created surplus. Without that additional water, Lake Mead would be in a far worse condition today. The longer-term challenge really is the Colorado River, and we are seeking to preserve that Lake Mead intentionally created surplus water for three main purposes. And those purposes include dry year reliability for Metropolitan. It also includes protecting against cutbacks from to meet drought contingency plan obligations. A number of years ago, we agreed to backstop California for the drought contingency plan, and the best way of doing that is by having money in the bank account in Lake Mead that we can pay that obligation right there in Lake Mead and not have a significant reduction in the actual diversions off the aqueduct. And then we want to be able to support Lake Mead for power operations and other operations. So we're looking at 2023 in terms of trying to preserve that intentionally created surplus and not pull that in order to be able to meet these kind of higher purpose, long-term goals. And that may require that we allocate supplies in order to preserve that. Now, there's some fluctuations, such as agricultural use and of the higher priority systems, that we will make a good estimate of what we think it will be, and then we can still use ICS to regulate that, to maintain our diversions. But we're looking at perhaps not pumping the full amount of water off the Colorado River Aqueduct that we can. So since August of 2021, we've been turning up the knob on this drought. Last August, we went to the Metropolitan Board for a resolution that established a water supply alert, which is the third of four categories that we use in messaging our water supply condition. By November, we had declared that emergency conditions exist in a portion of our service area, and that's that portion from the earlier slide, the State Water Project dependent area. And we said that if conditions don't change and we have a dry winter, that we may have to have a water shortage emergency condition, public hearing, and require some conservation or less use of the water. And unfortunately, last year, last winter's, the conditions were just that. Now, it's variable. I'll touch a little bit on this a little bit later. But last October, the city of Sacramento had more rainfall in a 24-hour period than they ever recorded in history. It was 5.4 inches in less than a day. If you've ever been to Sacramento, it's completely flat. There was a lot of water in the streets in Sacramento. Then November was very, very dry. There was almost no rainfall in November. We all had a great Thanksgiving. Then in December, the Central Sierra Snow Lab, which is near Donner Pass, had more than 16 feet of snow. And it was their record amount of snowfall ever measured in December. And then the spigot turned off. And we had the driest January, February, and March on record. In fact, they reduced our State Water Project allocation from 10% to 5%. So it just goes to show that the California's pattern is one of high variability. In fact, nowhere in the country is hydrology more variable than in California, in the mountain areas of California. And it's because of these atmospheric rivers. You get hit by, say, I don't know, 3 to 5 big atmospheric rivers. That's like an average year. 7, you've got your rowboat out. 2, you have a drought emergency. It's just the way that that water system comes, the hydrology comes in. Well, in August, staff brought before our board a call to action and a commitment to reliability, that it was not acceptable that in only one portion of our service area that we had to constrain water use, that we couldn't help out with water that was also available from other parts of the service area. So we committed to equitable water supply reliability across our service area. Now, ideally, we would like equitable and fully 100% reliable water service. But in the event that could not be provided and some reductions would be needed, we would want those reductions to be equitable across the whole service area. This past month, we did declare a regional drought emergency and calling on all agencies to reduce their use voluntarily of State Water Project supplies and Colorado River supplies, and issued yet kind of another notice or warning, just like we did in November of 2021, that if conditions don't change significantly, we'll likely have to allocate water supplies by the beginning of the spring of 2023. And that would be this regional water supply allocation. Now, let me talk a little bit about what that is. It was part of our water surplus and drought management plan that the board established just before the turn of the century, in 1999. And it says that we will work with our member agencies to minimize the impact of water shortages on the region. And there's really three elements to that. One is we're trying to limit the economic impact, and so take smaller steps a little bit earlier on rather than a really big step that has significant economic consequences. We also want to recognize that different agencies have different dependencies on Metropolitan, and not because they haven't done their job, but there's just some accidents of geography. You may or may not be sitting on top of a great groundwater basin. You may or may not have an ability to have large amounts of water recycling or stormwater capture. And then also to recognize those who have developed their resources. The whole water supply allocation is attempting to balance these needs. So our board, originally we worked with our board in 2008 to develop this. It was implemented 3 years in 2009, 2010, in 2015, and then we have revised and updated it and really put a lot of thought into the allocation formulas and what is equitable across the region. And it's a needs-based approach in an attempt to maintain equity across all of our member agencies. I won't go through each of these, but because there's a whole bunch of kind of wonky stuff that goes into this water supply allocation plan. But again, the attempt is to have an equitable allocation of our imported water supplies. And we consider existing conservation. We consider change in local supply. If an agency has lost an individual source, changes in population and economic growth, all which would balance in a way to equitably share in a shortage. And then there's three elements of that. There's a base period, which is kind of a time period. The current base period was 2013 and 14, or it might be 2014 and 2015. I can't quite remember. Those 2 years, the average. And then we would make adjustments off of that base period. But as that base period gets further in the past, some of our objectives of really having it best reflect the efforts of the agencies falls short. So we will be establishing a new base period for water supply allocation. Then the allocation formula iterates on the amount of water that's available and the reduction in the imported part of the supply. And then over a one-year period, there's a volume of water that we allow the agencies to determine how they work within. We don't step in and say that must be a single day per week watering like we had to do in the Emergency Water Conservation Program because it was so acute. So where are we in this timeline? We're in that first gray box at the left in January, this developing supply situation. And as we see all around us, that's what's happening. Then we will be making a decision on the water supply allocation in the April or May time period. Member agencies would have several months to prepare, and then we would have an allocation year that would begin July 1 of 2023 and go for one full calendar year. And of course, there's another winter period within that 12-month period. And in past allocations, the best way to get a really wet year is to allocate water, and then that next year, there's lots of rainfall, and several times we've been able to lift that allocation before the end of the 12-month period. So we're coordinating with our member agencies. This just shows when we'll be working with a subset of member agencies, any member agency which wishes to participate. We'll also be working with the member agency managers, and then tentative board action in April for this water supply allocation. So that concludes the remarks that I had for this. But let me rewind just a little bit to the graphic, and we can talk about some developing conditions. I think it was this one. Yes. So we expect about 1.7 million acre-feet of demand for 2023. And right now, we have a supply-demand gap of about 600,000 acre-feet. So almost one-third of the expected demand, we have this supply-demand gap that we'd be bringing from storage or from other resources or from conservation. We've had a lot of snowpack, a lot of precipitation in the past 2 weeks or so. The state just released the snow surveys. They do one snow survey at the Phillips Station, and that was 174% of normal for that date. All in all, the most important critical snowpack for us in the Sierras is the Northern Sierra stations, and those are about 135% of normal for this time of year. And the H-station index, which is a broader measure of rainfall, not just snow, is at about 115% of normal to date. Now, Lake Oroville, if you looked at a Lake Oroville graphic, Lake Oroville is kind of shooting up quite nicely. It's gained about 400,000 acre-feet since the beginning of December, and about 300,000 acre-feet of that was from the most recent storms. And so it's about 1.4 million acre-feet now. But where it's at now is only 73% of its historical average. So it's about where it was last year, and you remember what happened last year. So we're cautiously optimistic. My wife tells me to be happy for any rain we get and don't be pessimistic. We are planning for the potential for it to turn dry, but we are encouraged by this early rainfall. Now, the Colorado River Basin, much, much bigger basin, and it has a different problem than really the Sierras, which is just kind of single-year droughts. There's less water reaching the rivers because of warming temperatures than what normally happens. So the Northern Sierras, much more flashy. You get super low years, super big years. But the Colorado is in what the scientists are calling aridification, which is just a drying out. And about 9% less water reaches the rivers for every degree centigrade increase in average temperature. And since it's such a big basin, that's why it has such a big effect. So for right now, we have a big hole on the Colorado, which would take, well, frankly, which may not be refilled in my lifetime. The State Water Project System, we expect it to be flashy, and it might take 2 years to recover. So we're cautiously optimistic, but still watching the existing conditions. How we would get ourselves out of this drought condition, the first thing that happens with the State Water Project System is that we would be able to relieve those quite severe restrictions of water use in the State Water Project dependent area. For 2022, from June to December, for example, we had to restrict Las Virgenes Municipal Water District to less than 73% below their normal use of imported supplies. So that's where that kind of that first water that goes. Then we begin to back off of the use of Colorado. I told you we were pushing Colorado as far east. We'd start backing off of that and refilling storage in the State Water Project System. And then ultimately, we might be able to make some advances in not having to divert as much Colorado River supplies and put water into Lake Mead. But that's less and less likely. So, again, I would say we're optimistic, but it would still say that we're potentially on track for needing to allocate water supplies region-wide because of the severe drought on the Colorado Basin. That concludes my remarks, and I'd be happy, if time permits, to take any questions.
Absolutely. I'm sure we have some questions. Director Armstrong, would you like to start off?
Sure. No, this is really, really helpful and really great comparison between the State Water Project and the Colorado River. So I learned a little bit. So a couple things on the Colorado River. First, on Lake Mead, that intentionally created storage. I understand how you said it would be used, but could Metropolitan actually take that water if they really wanted to, that intentionally created storage, if you really wanted to? Is it there to take?
There is a set of rules that allows Metropolitan to take that water through 2026. The Secretary of Interior, through their examination of the rules, there's a potential that they could change the rules of the game a little bit. But we can take that water. But if we take that water, it doesn't relieve us of the DCP payment, that DCP contribution. And you just have to say, where would we want to pay that contribution
right.
from?
Right. Okay. And then I don't know if you could expand more on that we'll never see that basin recover in your lifetime. So I know like right now we're monitoring the state and we got the measurements yesterday and so we saw that's looking good start. Do we do the same kind of evaluation of the Colorado River Basin as it's going through the year and how are things looking there or what really does need to happen?
Right. So that's a really good question. And yes, we do monitor the conditions on the Colorado. One of the things is that there's a higher proportion of precipitation that comes outside of that winter season in the Colorado Basin. You know, we have monsoons, there's other spring rainfall. But I would say that the big thing that's really happening on that system is that there is less water reaching the rivers compared to the normal snowfall. And that's because of the big area and the warming temperatures. And that's something that doesn't reverse itself really quickly. And I also mentioned that California and the Sierras are highly variable. So we still expect that high variability in California. Now, that peak of runoff in California may shift earlier. That causes a problem. But on the Colorado, it's much more stable, which is both good and bad. Here's another way that I've described it. A drought and the drought and climate adjustments that we're in, it's like you're on a escalator and using a yo-yo. And so the yo-yo that you're doing is all of the year-to-year variability. But and you're on an escalator that's slowly going in one direction. So sometimes it's hard to know whether where the yo-yo is because of where you are on the escalator or where the yo-yo is going up and down. But we definitely see that escalator climbing in terms of temperatures, and that's one of the bigger effects on the Colorado Basin.
Thank you.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that the difference between Colorado and our Sierras before, but that makes a lot of sense. The current storm that's going through, is it hitting the Rockies or the Western Rockies?
It is. In fact, the Rockies are at 142% of normal, so the Brog ones. So those storms, it depends a little bit on which storm, but in general, those big atmospheric rivers then make havoc further east and lay snow down in the Rockies as well. So they're above normal precipitation and snowpack for this time of year.
Okay. All right, thank you. Great presentation.
Thank you. I had a question, a couple questions. The first one is on your like needs assessment. So you're kind of looking at different agencies and what, you know, what they've got or what they're doing. If an agency isn't doing much, if they're not doing recycled water and they're not, I mean, like Eastern, we do everything. And I'm just thinking, well, if an agency maybe isn't even doing anything, they're just figuring, well, hey, if we don't do anything, we obviously need more. So, you know, does it kind of push people not to do as much or, you know, spend the money? Because, I mean, we've spent a lot of money to ensure our sustainability. Is that being taken into consideration?
Yes, I'll respond in two ways. One is that I'm really unaware of agencies who aren't doing anything. So it's kind of a degree of how much. It also is a little bit reflective of what resources you have available immediately, for example, groundwater basin, that you can rely on. But it does acknowledge that the agencies have both different needs and different capabilities. For example, if one greatly reduced and already put into place a lot of measures that reduced its per capita use, then the allocation formula is less strict on dropping that, an indicator of per capita use. So, in fact, in our allocation plan, we have a limit of 100 gallons per person per day for total use and 50 gallons per person per day for indoor use as floors. And so there's, for example, the city of Santa Ana, one of our member agencies, its per capita use is already well below 100 GPCD, and so it would be less affected because that next amount of reduction in supply really comes out of essential indoor use. So it targets a bit the less essential outdoor use as well.
Okay, and then my other question on the Colorado, I think it's pretty obvious over the many years that, you know, when they first allocated the water, they didn't get it quite right as to how much water actually flows in the river. Is there any discussion about re-looking at that and saying, hey, really, there's only about 12 million or whatever that's going in. We're going to have to, you know, change the numbers.
There's a great book called Science Be Damned that was written about the early studies on the Colorado River. John Fleck and one of his co-authors wrote it. And it talked about that what happened early on. And Fleck says that for political expediency, the negotiators chose a more liberal view of the hydrology. And there was sufficient information that existed at that time even to allocate less water between all the parties. Said and done, that water's been allocated and the river's in a structural deficit. The California versus Arizona Supreme Court decision in 1963, I believe it was, also settled some issues about tributary flows in Arizona and whether those were considered part of that 7.5 million acre feet, or if that was separate for Arizona. And as you know, California lost that Supreme Court decision. So those are kind of a couple of different things. The bottom line is that there has to be a reckoning with this system, and we're looking at two things. One is to get through this more immediate need, this drought conditions that may exceed our existing rules to keep the system working well by the end of 2026. So that's like the first most critical thing that's being negotiated. And then the longer-term plan for the river post-2026 also needs to be negotiated. And we expect that there will be less water on average used, because clearly there's a structural imbalance.
Thank you.
So I just, again, thank you for being here. Great presentation. Appreciate it very much. This is probably more of a comment than a statement, but you can certainly weigh in. And I mean, I look at this map of California, and I look at the right side. It's a very limited amount of water, that obviously the river is stressed. The left side is an unlimited amount of water called the Pacific Ocean. I still say at some point ocean desal has to be part of our portfolio in Southern California going forward. I just don't see how it isn't. Yes, there's a greater cost, and us as a society's got to come to the point where we accept that greater cost on energy use. But I'd just like to get your thoughts on, I know it's a politically loaded question, but as an expert in supply, where is that going to fit in the next 20 to 30 years?
What I would say is that ocean desalination cannot be off the table. And there are some who want it categorically off the table. My view is it should not be off the table. The largest ocean desalination plant in the Western Hemisphere is in Carlsbad, a 50,000 acre feet per year facility. There's one on Catalina Island. There's one that's being proposed in Dana Point. And for me, it's also a little bit about, say, a portfolio. So you talk to someone about financial risk, and the five directors might have each individually different perceptions of risk and on their own portfolio. And that's the exact same way that we look at it as an agency. So one agency might want to use ocean desalination because of their risk tolerance for water shortages. And I want that to not be off the table, that agencies can do that. I would point, as well as to the left side, which would be the Pacific Ocean, to the line going across from the west side to the east. And that's Metropolitan's Colorado River Aqueduct. Mm-hmm. 1.2 million acre feet capacity. And if you look at that map, you see like this U-shaped thing. It might look like one river. And it really gives us an opportunity to slosh water back and forth between two of the most important watersheds in the West. And what this allows is it allows, for example, Las Vegas, it allows Phoenix to invest in projects in Southern California in exchange for us leaving some of the water in the Colorado. For example, Las Vegas could, and they had in a previous administration there had talked about it, could invest in ocean desalination in Southern California, and the water could be exchanged. Likewise, if we improve the reliability of the State Water Project system, we can, in essence, move water into storage on the Colorado system by reducing our pumping, our normal year pumping from the Colorado. So ocean desalination should not be off the table. It is part of a risk analysis that each individual agency and the region as a whole should be making. And there's also great opportunities with moving water between the two different great watersheds.
Good. I appreciate the answer. And it's just we at Eastern are actually looking at participating in the Doheny project. And I just think I agree with you. It needs to be part of the water portfolio. It shouldn't. It just needs to. To me, it's an untapped resource, not to make a pun, of things that we in the future have to look at as Southern California continues to grow and our water needs. I mean, conservation only gets us so far. We need to expand that portfolio of water. So,
President Pauly, can I ask a question?
Of course.
So Brad, thank you for the great presentation. This is very helpful. Looking at the conditions, the near-term conditions for 2023, and I realize that it's still too early to predict what will happen up in the Sierra Nevada area, but currently there's a state water project allocation of 5%. And what percent allocation do you believe we need to achieve to avoid an allocation for this year? And I know there's been some discussion of that at Met. Can you maybe share some thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's kind of the I'll do it in three different bins. So there's a relatively low allocation where right now we're accessing human health and safety water that's being allocated differently. In essence, urban agencies are able to make a case for the Department of Water Resources for the human health and safety needs of water, and that water isn't yet being allocated for agricultural users in the state. We're at 5% now. The balance point is somewhere between 15 and 20%. Let's call it 15%. And so for the first 15% of the water allocation, that is replacing human health and safety needs. So the region doesn't really get any more water up to 15% allocation. Then let's say 15% to 50% maybe in that range, we're rebuilding storage. Because if we use just exactly 15% of the water, you go back to no water in storage. And you're much more vulnerable for a next dry year on the State Water Project dependent areas than you are in the rest of the system. And our commitment through the board action in August that we would bring this reliability, equivalent water supply reliability. So that next chunk of water, we refill storage, carryover storage in San Luis, storage in Castaic Lake. So we're rebuilding that storage. Then we do things like we turn off drafting of Diamond Valley Lake and we start putting water in Diamond Valley Lake. And then somewhere north of 60%, then we can start blending water like we used to love to do with the State Water Project, bring down the salinity and reduce our pumping on the aqueduct, Colorado River Aqueduct, which then puts more water into Lake Mead because we could put, say, 400 or 500,000 acre feet into Lake Mead. And when we get to a point where we're actually putting significant amounts of water in Lake Mead, that's probably the point where we say we don't need to we don't need an allocation for this year. So north of 50 to 60%, I would say, allocation.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming out and visiting us today with that great, great report.
Happy to do it at any time. So, thank you.
Thank you.
We will move on to item 7 on our agenda today, which is to receive and file various reports. I will make the motion to do so.
Second.
Director Armstrong seconds the motion. I might get a roll call vote, please.
Pauly?
Aye.
Director Cronin?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. That brings us to our calendar review. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning and Happy New Year, President Pauly and members of the board. I have two events for your consideration today. One is on January 19th, is a welcome reception for Metropolitan Chair Adan Ortega with a update on the California water supply. The second event is Thursday, February 9th. It is with Municipal Water District of Orange County's Water Policy Forum dinner. And both of those flyers are attached to your review packet for you. Turning to page 2 is the current listing of the board members' master calendar for the next 2 weeks. Please let me know if you have any changes or updates on the calendar. And at the top of page 3 is the upcoming conference and events with participation. We have the dedication ceremony on January 12th, followed by Moreno Valley's Chamber of Commerce Installation Award Banquet on January 27th. February 16th through the 17th is the Cal DESAL Conference, and February 22nd through the 24th is the Urban Water Institute Conference, along with the Multi-State Salinity Coalition Summit. So information regarding these events are at the back of your calendar packet. On the continuing on page 3, on the board and board committee meetings, please note that next board meeting on January 18th, which is a Wednesday, that meeting is extended for the cost of service session. And then additionally for February, we've moved the administrative committee to February 8th at 7:30 in the morning. Otherwise, all other committee meetings and board meetings are on schedule through March. And the top of page 4 is the interagency meetings. Elsinore Valley joint meeting has been rescheduled to Monday, January 23rd, and all other meetings are on schedule through March. EMWD's offices will be closed Monday, January 16th, and February, January 20th, in observation of holidays. And that is all. Are there any questions regarding the calendar review?
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We will go to board members' attendance reports. Director Corona.
The only report I have is my meeting with General Manager, which was a great meeting, as always. And that's all I have.
Very good. Director Slauson.
I did not attend the Chamber of Commerce meeting of the 28th, and we did not have a SAPA meeting yesterday.
Very good. Do I have director's comments or future agenda item requests? Seeing none, I'll ask legal counsel if we have a need for closed session today.
We do not, Mr. Chair.
Very good. With that, we will stand adjourned until Wednesday, January 18th at 9 a.m. Thank you very much.